The picture I've chosen is by L.A. Ring, Laurits Andersen Ring. Part of the title is Waiting for the Train. And that painting just hit me immediately when I saw it. It's something in the eyes of the guy standing there with his bike and waiting for that train to pass so that he can pass. There's something for me about industrialization in that time and age. You know, this guy, he must ride his bike back and forth every day. And he's looking at, where's the damn train? Where are we all going to go from here? Today it's trains, tomorrow it's, There's something in his eyes where he's just confronted with modernity and the modern times and his own existence in the waiting of the train that just hit me like a hammer. And that face, lost in transition, just struck me. I mean, you have to see it up front. That's where you get the impact from it. Laurits Andersen, he was a socialist. He went around with a gun waiting for revolution. And he was the embodiment, actually, of Jente in some ways, because he was all about the commoner. He painted for the commoner and he painted the commoners. He was tied into the working community and the worker. Maybe it's the old socialist in me that also feels aligned with him.
My name is Tinne Christensen, and I'm the host of Danish Originals, a podcast series created in partnership with the American Friends of the National Gallery of Denmark. Our goal is to celebrate Danish creatives who've made a significant mark in the US. Today, our guest is Lars Mikkelsen, a Danish actor. Welcome, Lars.
Thank you.
I am at my home in Los Angeles with a view to a pool and palm trees. Where are you and what does your view look like? I can see lots of books behind you.
Yeah, I'm in my apartment in Copenhagen. It's freezing. It's just above zero. Everything's melting now, but yeah, it's pretty winterish.
Above 0 Celsius, we should add to our Fahrenheit Celsius, listeners. Since the last movie I saw you in was Frankenstein, I would like to start our chat by asking you about this. You play Captain Andersen in the film, and your men are stuck in the ice on the way to the North Pole when you meet Frankenstein and his monster. They were adventurers, the Danish shipmen or the Danish sailors, and they were explorers. Are you yourself like that? Could you see yourself in Captain Andersen?
Not at all.
No.
I really like my home and being around friends, and I'm not much of a traveler really, but I must say, I mean, the job has brought me abroad a lot, and I do travel a lot with that nowadays, but if it was just up to me, I'd just stick around here.
You would never be stuck in the ice in the North Pole.
I'd never be stuck in the ice of the North Pole. I really don't like the cold at all. No.
Nikolaj Lie Kaas and Joachim Fjelstrup are among the Danish actors who are cast alongside you in Frankenstein. It is a great film shot by the amazing Guillermo del Toro. And you actually help Guillermo with the script because you get to speak your own language in the film too. What kind of translation did you do for him? And how did the two of you collaborate on the text?
I think we all did. I mean, it was written down in English, of course. We took it from there. We just had a discussion between us, the three Danes, and this translation. I mean, it's not very elaborate. We're saying, shoot, or, we just did it, and he trusted what we did, and of course, he couldn't understand what we were saying, but he's so good at what he does, and he knows what he wants. In that sense, he, of course, understood more or less what we were saying, But we took it back and forth a couple of times, and we had a go of it.
When I spoke to him at the after party of Frankenstein in Toronto, he spoke very highly of you and said he was in love with your face. Ooh. And he immediately decided to give you a role in his next film, a stop motion film. What is it like getting this kind of praise from a director of his caliber? Does it motivate you to be even more ambitious? And are you ambitious, or are you too affected by the Danish jantelov to admit that to us?
That's an elaborate question. Am I ambitious? To a certain extent, I am. I'd like to do stuff that has a certain kind of challenge and a certain kind of significance, I'd say. the older you get, there's so many things you've visited and there's no need to revisit. But what I look for is, does it have a significant story? Is there something here that is worthwhile, really? Mm-hmm. And of course it's worthwhile when it's Guillermo. And of course it makes an impact on me that he says that. I felt that we had that. It was really nice. Mm-hmm. It's very accommodating, very open, very nice to work with. So in that sense, I mean, even though it was such a vast and big set, it just felt like what we do here, really. We had real sort of discussions back and forth of what we're doing. That whole first sequence is a big setup. It's one of those directors where he can do anything, yeah? He can do the whole machine, the big machine and the small machine. I mean, when we get into the cabin later on, he's very good with the actors. Trust his actors, but he's also there for them. Nursing of what we're doing, yeah, and he understands.
He's a very gentle soul, right?
He is, and he's a very funny soul also. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And I think there's something there with the sarcasm. He's got funny bones, real funny bones. Yeah, mm-hmm. It's long shoots. Humor really helps.
Yes, it does. Do you think the Danish gentle has affected you in any way?
Oh yeah.
Is it a factor?
Oh, yeah, of course it is. There's a real gap between how you consider yourself in this country and in other parts of the world. I mean, because we grew up with that. And it's got two sides to it. In one way, it's good that you align yourself with everybody else. Mm-hmm. And you never sort of become wildly taken with yourself. And then there's the other side to it, is that we can have a hard time actually embracing that we are maybe better some things than other people are. So mm-hmm. it's got those two layers to it. I mean, it's good and bad to that, I mm-hmm. think. Mm-hmm. So I rarely praise myself. I rarely do that. So it's really nice that he does. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. Frankenstein is a big Hollywood production. It's an American production. It has a huge budget. It was shot on a stage in Toronto, as is the case with many Hollywood productions. The Danish film industry is pretty impressive, but we don't do movies on Guillermo's scale, budget-wise. No. How would you describe being on a big set like that? What are the main differences from these big Hollywood productions and the smaller sets in Denmark, which are also impressive in their own way?
The main difference is that we'd never be able to do that start sequence in Denmark. It's not possible. So we concentrate on what we're doing in the cabin later on. I mean, so on the relations, on what happens between people, because there's so many similarities, I'd say. Mm-hmm. You know, the job's the same. The moment you're in front of the camera, the same. It's staying true to what the material gives you, the other actors, and the story you're telling. And you have to forget about the whole big machine around it. I'd say there are more similarities than there are differences. The biggest difference is that on a big scale, we'd never be able to do stunts, and we can never do the big machine. I'd say the lunch budget alone on some of these things is a Danish movie. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What about the social aspects of it? Do you just come to set, do your thing, and leave and go home? Is it strictly professional? Do you get to know people?
I think everybody's there for the work. So you don't hang out every day, but you do when there's an opportunity to do it. Yeah. So once in a while you can do it, keeping in mind that you're actually here to do the work. This time around, we were three Danes and we had a week off and stuff. That was quite nice because we hung out quite a lot, dinners and training and stuff like that. Mm. But you do it to that extent that it won't hurt your work.
Mm-hmm. Guillermo del Toro is from Mexico, and he said to me that the Danes are very much like the Mexicans in the sense that they are just crazy.
Yeah.
He loved that about you. Yeah. Did you see the comparison? And is it how you see the Danes too as a little crazy, or how would you characterize us as a people?
I think we are a little crazy. Yeah. Yeah. taking away the Yandelol that sometimes put a lid on everything. Once we sort of leave that behind and we're on a job like this, yeah, it would become a bit crazy in a good way. Yeah, these characters need that. That movie needs that sort of embrace.
What do you think he meant by it? Maybe the humor?
I think it's, yeah, the humor. I think it's that, yeah, you're down on your 12th, 14th hour of shooting and you can still crack a joke and have a laugh. And you don't sit around moaning about your wet feet or whatever. You're having a good time. This is a once-in-a-lifetime experience for me. So let's have a laugh while we're doing it, yeah? And that might come across as being a bit crazy, yeah.
Guillermo changed the original script in Mary Shelley's book. Frankenstein is based on her book. They were British. He changed them to Danish. And you speak both Danish and English in the film. He said that there is something in Danish men that leads back to the Vikings. They're robust and mythical, he said. What do you personally think the switch meant for the story? That they were Danish instead of British?
It brings it out a bit, doesn't it? It sort of opens the story a bit more, that it's not all British or confined to that circle of storytelling, that it's a bit more universal, that we come from another country. Apart from that, it's the same story. We're doing what they do in the book. Like Dracula, at that time, a lot of these novels were constructed on letters, called fictional letters, from the captain to his sister. And in Dracula, it's between the main characters. That's not part of it. We discussed at one point that if that should be a part of it, these letters going back and forth, sort of fictional sister. I was a bit like, you don't need it, mate, because it's such a good story. It's so tight. As it is. Mm-hmm. And of course, it didn't become in that way. But that's also really nice that he's sort of, oh, should we do that? We could do that. Maybe we should do that. Yeah. Because it makes the working space come alive. You know, that when he shares that with me. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's nice.
And speaking of Vikings, you were the host in a television series about the history of Denmark, going all the way back to the Ice Age. It's a 10-episode documentary series, and I had the pleasure of watching it for the first time during my Christmas break. Even though it's from 2017, it was really good. Oh. Through reenactments of historical situations and interviews with scholars, and with you as the host, it tells our country's history. What were the highlights of making this series for you? And what did you learn about our nation that you did not know in advance?
Oh, so much. Yeah. As an actor, of course, you know a little about your history because whenever you do something about something from 1800s to 1900s, what we call the modern breakthrough, and then you sort of dig into what did that mean in that time and age, for Strindberg, what did that mean for these characters in that time and age? But it's always a sort of very narrow pin that you put into that time in history. So this time I sort of had the big overlaying vision of that whole period from the Ice Age till modern times. And I met all the professors that knew the most of it. I visited all the places that were significant in that sense. I learned so much. And I'm so proud of it. I have small kids coming up to me in the streets going,
it's you from the history of Denmark, isn't it?
And yeah, it's me. Yeah. Because, again, what you pushed on with one of your early questions, to find something significant to do with what we can do, yeah? Mm-hmm. So we're not just repetitive in that sense. Saying, oh, I can do this. Let me do that again and again and again. This was nerve-wracking going into that storytelling of our national history. But it was, at the same time, I felt it was poignant and significant. Mm-hmm. That you being part of telling the story of our national history to the next generation. Mm-hmm. And in 20 years, somebody else has to do it because history is ever flowing. It's not a constant. We look at history and tell it from there. Mm-hmm. And in 20 years, they'll look differently on that national history and it'll have been told again.
Mm-hmm. We are reminded that the Vikings went far. They also went to America. And we do learn that the Danish language infiltrated English, we kind of knew, but we're reminded that we say egg and window and knife, for instance, in English because of the Vikings. Those words derives from Danish. The Vikings actually being present on the British islands for quite a while, and Britain was part of Denmark for a short time. Were there any other fun words that you were reminded of?
There were other words, but can't remember. I say, after we'd done the whole thing, I actually had the idea that you should follow words around Europe and see how they evolved and where they originated from. And because a lot of the Danish language actually originates from Germanic or French. So saying it's actually the Viking, it could be actually something Latin or something Germanic that led into that. I don't really know, but I'd really like to do that show where you follow words.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I love languages and I think most actors do because we're into words.
Did this program lead you to do more research about certain parts of our history, and have you become a history buff since then?
I don't know. I've always been interested in history. I told you before, we hit on a certain character, a certain place and period in time. We sort of dig into that time. So it's always fun, but I have a tendency to not be able to remember what year was that. It's just, I have a different kind of brain.
Yeah. I think that's okay. The series also reminds us of our history with Christianity, how we believed in the Nordic gods like Odin, and how the Vikings were introduced to Christianity. I know that you yourself found a Christian pass, so to speak, when you played a priest in the Danish TV series Right Upon the Storm, it's called in English. He's a priest, does not seem to behave quite like one expects a priest to behave, but this role led you to become baptized into the National Danish Church. Can you talk a little about your relationship to the church and what it means to you and how this role led you there?
Part of what you do, I do as an actor, is talking to people, doing my research before get into it. So I was talking to these various priests and I had a look around at many, because the Danish church is not one thing as such. It's up for interpretation by the local priest. Now this character I played is what we call the Grundtvigian, from a character called Grundtvig from the 1800s. It was quite a character too. He was bipolar. And in many ways, this character was too. So I went astray there. But having talked to all these priests, I just found at one point that, at least within me, there's this constant search for meaning throughout. You might gather that from when I say, let's do something significant also, But that's been part of my life all the way through. And our childhood was alcoholics. My mother was an alcoholic. And I always had that dialogue to sort of try to exist through something that was hard to understand for me at that point. So within that church that we are, and the priests that are the conveyors of the faith, I actually found exactly what I wanted in terms of discussing the existence. I just embraced that. I had to embrace it. Do you know, like when you find something, like when you're walking along, this is good. Maybe it's, I don't know. But if you walk on the seaside, and you find that small stone, you didn't know you were going to find it. You have to put it in your pocket. Because somehow you've always been searching for exactly that stone. So in that sense, I just had to embrace it. It puts you on edge in this business, at least in this country, because we're so secular, especially in this business. It was not a popular thing when I sort of expressed it, but it was a thing I had to do. Mm-hmm. I just had to do it. So I got baptized one morning. One of my friends was also a believer, and the priest. Beautiful. Small ceremony. It was just, you know, to bring the dialogue closer.
Mm-hmm.
Do you understand why? Mm-hmm. I have this notion that people understand what I say when I say that.
No, I think I do.
But I just needed to bring the dialogue closer and mm-hmm. not be a hypocrite about it, because this is what I do. I do have this dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's really nice.
Does it bring you peace somehow?
Oh yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. And first and foremost, it just brings me in line with something that I can address my problems and my thank yous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's beautiful. Yeah. Have you had other roles that were life-changing in this way? You so intensely go into the material that it's almost inevitable that it will affect you somehow. But have there been any other roles that do that to you?
Yeah, I mean, my wife says it happens all the time. So,
she's so like, sense, next time you'll become a Buddhist.
Oh my God, not again. Yeah, you always bring something from what you do. I expect everybody does, really. Yeah, it could be the collaboration between the cast, or it could be sort of the insight you get from a very well-written text. It can be sort of the embrace of a character that makes you understand something within yourself. You always bring something with you.
Mm.
It's not that it's always the whole character you bring. At one point, I played a pedophile mass murderer. And luckily, you don't bring that with you. But there's always some small understandings, something within it. And especially with Shakespeare, you bring the sort of inner understanding of the text that sort of grows with you as you get older. That also gives to your life and sort of, yeah, it becomes part of you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, in that sense, yeah, I always do it, but I can't pinpoint it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And maybe it's time to go back in history and talk a little bit about what made you become an actor in the first place. You just described your childhood as a little rough. It must have been a little rough having a mom who is an alcoholic. Your brother also became an actor. His name is Mads Mikkelsen. And he's also, like yourself, an international star. So maybe you can detect something in your childhood that led the two of you to decide to become actors. Maybe the need to express yourself artistically. Or maybe something else.
There's a lot to be said for the time and age we grew up in, where we could have a look around. We weren't forced into education as such. You could spend some years having a look around. I think some of that is the difficulties of alcoholism that will enhance your emotional enlightenment. I wouldn't consider myself to be very intellectual or very academic in that sense, but I do have an understanding of what happens on an emotional basis with people in conflict. And I think that could have sort of been a foundation somehow. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there's very nice things in that home too. We had radio plays and old skits with comedians and stuff. And we'd sort of go through that. My mum would sing with us, stage songs and stuff. Our father would read a lot to us. So it's a mixture. So in some ways, we were sort of nurtured into having an interest for it. Our hunger for all that was just enormous. Our father had to put his readings into tape because he was just exhausted. We wanted more. So in that sense, yeah, and so that emotional insight, I'd say, yeah, and the time and age. So yeah, bit of all that shit, yeah.
Yes. And you went to Sjællandske school. What were you like as a student? And was there a drama teacher or somebody else who inspired you in a special way to initiate an actor spark in you that eventually led you to skip the biology studies and study at the Danish National School of Theatre?
I don't think so. Sjællandske was just the first 2 years of my audition for Copenhagen Boys Choir School called St. Annie. Yeah. And then from third grade, I went to that and became a part of the Copenhagen Boys Choir over a period of 2 years or something. And I sang there for 2 or 3 years until your voice turns. So in a sense, there's something there where I sort of started performing with the choir. And it's quite a professional choir, even though we're just boys. First and foremost, we were just boys. But you did understand when you were conveying, when you were communicating. Mm. Yeah? And after that, I went into the military and then university just for half a year, I think, biology. And then my girlfriend, wife now, came home and could juggle after 2 days on a juggling course. And I went, oh my God. I was there with 1,000 pages, books, you know, and I went along. And that was the first time I actually felt that this is me, this is right. Because they were an edge of society at that point. I felt at home. For the first time in my life. And then 5 years of juggling, street performing, clowning, led into somebody handing me The Storm by Shakespeare. And I just couldn't understand it, but I knew there was something there that I wanted to learn. I wanted to understand. And that led to me applying for the schools, and then, yeah, I became an actor.
Yeah. I know that there was a clown, a Russian clown, Slava Polunin, who inspired you. How did you get to know about him, and what was it about him that inspired you so much?
They came here. There was a clown company. It must have been the 90s, maybe. Late 80s, early 90s, Slava Polunin, and I've I think the performance was called Litze Day or something like that. And they were just brilliant clowns. From an early age, my grandfather, he was a communist. Yeah. You got to understand that communism at that point was a working class thing. You were either social democrat or communist, yeah? And it was a party where the workers struggled to get part of the economy. But every time the Russian state circus came, we had to go see that, had to see that. And the first time the Russian state circus came around, it was them and Oleg Popov. He was a clown. 10 years after they came, it was Oleg Popov and the Russian state circus. Because he was so phenomenal. And there's something about that approach. I don't know if it's like that nowadays, but at that point, that approach to the clown that the Russian sat, they made the child come alive on stage. They didn't throw cakes in each other's faces. They didn't slap each other like the Italian clowns did. They just let the child express itself on stage. And it was just so funny and so poetic. So I really wanted to be that. I was sure that was what I was going to do. Slava Polunin had that same feel, with the same approach to the child on stage. I was just mesmerized by it, and I wanted to do that. But then somebody handed me a text, and then I got astray from there.
Okay. You have also played a Russian president. He is called Viktor Petrov. He is calculating, manipulative, and cold-hearted, which is also the case with most of the American politicians in the series, by the way. It is called House of Cards, and it is quite a cynical depiction of American politics in particular. How would you describe the series and your role in it?
I love the series.
I do too.
I was very proud to be part of that. At one point, Kevin said that.
Kevin Spacey.
Yeah. He said in an interview, where we go from here, because we're being surpassed by what's really happening. So in that sense, certainly there are similarities right now, aren't there?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, but I was just proud to be a part of it and didn't really realize how big it was until I was there. One of the producers said, hey, this is one of the good ones. Got to know that. Yeah. I don't realize that. Yeah. Yeah. It was fun and big. I'd done a small film in Ireland and a small film in London. And I'd done Sherlock in London too. So I had some hair on my chest when I came there, but this was by far the biggest I've been part of at that point.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. Really nice.
And the first scene you shot in House of Cards, you were in the Oval Office with Kevin Spacey as he plays the American president. And the sets that you were on looks amazing. What did that set make you reflect on?
It made me scared shitless. It was the first day in the Oval Office. So, yeah, of course, it's a very iconographic setting. But you can't think on these things. When you're there, you've got to do what you're there for. Being there with Kevin, he's such a good actor that I can't sit there going, oh, my God, I've got to act, be part of the scene. So you don't let yourself be too influenced by that. And maybe the whole gender law thing is quite good there. We're not easily impressed. Mm-hmm. We're here to do the job. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, of course, if you think on it, if you start thinking on it, how can I do this? How can I sit across from Kevin? How can I match him? You've got to not go there. You just got to look into his eyes and go. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, he was very nice to me. Yeah.
Obviously, you've been in DC, but did you also get this opportunity to be part of the real thing, the White House? It's actually smaller than you think it is when you're there.
Is it? We didn't go to a real White House. That's why they built them.
Mm-hmm.
We did go to DC once, where we shoot my entourage arriving.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And as we did that, suddenly everything came to a halt, and the real president came driving. It was quite a meta thing. Wow. Whoa.
Yeah. All of a sudden, you were second to...
Yeah. You're taking my mojo, mate.
Yeah.
No, but that was fun. Yeah. Most of it was on studio. Some of the others might have been more up in DC doing stuff there. But most of it was studio, yeah.
Did it spark your interest in American politics? And do you feel that you have an advantage now that you've been behind the scenes?
Does anybody have that advantage?
You tell me.
Isn't it just too sort of random? I do follow. I think the whole world follows the Americans, what's happening, always done, because it's such a vast impact on a lot of us, what's being decided there. And at the moment... Everything here is about Greenland and the latest sort of, what you call it, idiocies, I have to say it. But no, I have no advantage and I don't think anybody has.
Yeah. You were a spin doctor in Nikolai Arcel's Kongekabale, or King's Game, as they call it in English. That's also a rather cynical film about Danish politics. What do you think are the main differences between the world of politics in the US and Denmark? Maybe right now the situation is different than it usually is.
It also has been over the last 20 years, and then security is tightening up also around here. I remember some of my friends in the States when they saw Borgen, and they asked me, do your prime minister really ride a bike around Copenhagen? Yeah. And I went, yeah, sure, yeah. But security has changed over the recent years because of various threats. It's very different societies. In many ways, we've created a society where everybody is approachable in some way. Yeah. Also, gender has something to do with that, that you should be approachable, which is good.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's true. but it's not always the truth because things are changing in terms of how professional politics are becoming here.
Mm-hmm.
We have a 13-party system. We have a variation of parties that we can vote for.
Mm-hmm.
And then they will make a coalition that normally will find a consensus of meanings. And then the politics will derive from there.
Mm-hmm.
That is not the situation in your country.
Mm-mm.
So
no.
That is very different from the States at the moment. Of course, we're also struggling in the whole of Europe with some of the same problems. There are a rising right wing and mm-hmm. also a left wing that is tangible. So let's see how long we have it. But I think there is a vast difference between our country and yours.
That's mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. one thing that is quite clear is that we have much, much healthier take on truth.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yep.
It was the role as Charles Magnusson in Sherlock with Martin Freeman and Benedict Cumberbatch that led the producers of House of Cards to you.
Yeah.
That was another great international series or British series.
Yeah,
were you a Sherlock Holmes fan like me? What attracted you to it?
I think we all are. Hadn't grown up in the 60s. They were part of what we consumed, these mm-hmm. really, really well-done BBC narrations of that. So, yeah, I loved it before. It's the foundation of a lot of new crime stories. That character is so iconic. And it's flown into a lot of other characters. I'd say Columbo's got a bit of that. You know, or there's something within that character that's flown into a lot of crime stories.
Mm-hmm. And it was the killing in Borgen that made you visible outside of Denmark. They became very popular abroad, mostly in the UK, but I also have a lot of American friends talking about Borgen. What did they mean to you, these two series?
Like anything on the road to sitting here today, it's all part of me, and it's part of me becoming who I am now as an actor. The killing was funny. It was 20 episodes on one murder, and we didn't know who'd done it when we started off. We didn't know until we got the last script. It was quite a thing in Denmark. I think at that point we were 5.5 million people, and I think there was 2 million watching it on Sundays when it came out. Yeah, whoa. So it was a big thing, yeah. It done what it did. It's fine. And then 2 years passed. And all of us were part of it. We'd forgotten about it. We were on to other things. And then suddenly it hit in UK. And it got sort of that second wind, the attention from the world outside. And it brought a lot of us out, yeah, because suddenly agents were engaging with us. And for me, at least, there had not been a possibility up until that point. I didn't know that you could, as a Dane, go outside the borders. I think that was, for all of us, a bit of a shock, a bit of a sort of, wow, whoa, okay, let's step on this roller coaster. That's fine. Yeah. So, yeah. And Borgen came after that and sort of did the same thing and also made people aware that we're still here. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I think the killing was significant for me first, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm. You worked with your wife. Do you think you will work with your brother, Mads, in the future, or is it too close to home?
If it happens, it happens. It's not that we don't want it, but if it happens, it happens. It's not something we seek out. It's not something we don't seek out. It's like, I think that generation, we sort of wait for the phone to ring. It won't come from us, I think.
I know you both played handball when you were kids. Are you competitive with each other?
Oh, yeah. Less nowadays, yeah. It doesn't really make sense anymore because none of us can really run anymore. Well, yeah, we were when we were small, yeah. Everything, yeah. Everything.
He's your little brother.
In a healthy way. It's nice to have a brother to compete with, yeah.
You are an acclaimed actor, but following your international work, and maybe especially The Witcher, which became a huge success, now you're an international star. How does fame treat you? Is it a positive experience or maybe less so?
It's so funny you say that. I don't consider myself to be that. I'm an actor, yeah? And I don't really think much about it. I don't know. I don't know. It doesn't really enter my mind sphere at all.
No?
I really like the work. I really like the work. And hopefully I'd like it from here on. Yeah? Mm. There's always a possibility of sort of it drying out because it's tough sometimes. It's not tough to do the job, actually, but the whole shebang around it can be sometimes a bit of a,
red carpets, interviews, fans, all that.
Yeah, sort of from the outside, it looks like, oh, that must be fun. It's not really. It's crap. I'm here for the job. I like the work. It's fun. And like we were discussing earlier on, I'm here for the bits that I carry on from every job, for that sort of skin renewal that it sort of brings every time, yeah? And also for the learning. I'm still learning. And it was so much fun when we got out of Denmark, because happy to do it in another language and approach that. It's such a learning experience. Like here, I'm searching for words the whole time here in English to be concise about what I mean. I wouldn't do that in Danish. Yeah.
Mm.
So that learning experience of trying to make characters come alive in another language, because I'm so language-based, I derive from Shakespeare, from talking characters. Yeah, that's also what I normally do when I'm being cast in English or American productions. I do talking characters. I'm not sort of the mysterious guy in the corner. In that sense, it's such a learning experience. I hope that never stops. I really like learning, and I really like the journey that it brings me on every time.
Mm-hmm. How important do you think it is for you to work across borders? Do you think it helps us create bridges? And do you think art can help us build bridges?
Definitely. We can't always do that with what we do, change people. But we can make them think sometimes. Sometimes we can just entertain them, but does it make bridges? Does it construct bridges between people? Yeah, it does. It does. Sometimes. Like when people approach me and say, is it right that your prime minister really rides a bike to work? And I go, yeah, sure, yeah. So that telling that story of a society that is like that, it's right next to the life you live, but it's so different. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That we're the same, but so different. Yeah, I'd say first time I saw Van Gogh, first time I heard Beethoven, first time I saw a play with one of the grand old ladies here, where she was personifying that character to such a degree that everything came to a halt. Mm-hmm. It can do that. We can do that. And that will change your path. But we don't always do it. It's difficult.
And that's my final question to you. Mm. What is still on your bucket list? What do you still want to achieve?
People tend to ask me that, and it's very sort of present with me. Like I said, I'm in that generation where I'm so privileged that I sat myself down and waited for the phone to ring. And then somebody phoned me up, and then I'm suddenly part of something, and that will bring me somewhere. Yeah, a couple of times I had the privilege of defining something we wanted to do with Shakespeare, you know, but I consider it to be a minor sort of explorations. But my two young sons have become actors too.
Mm-hmm.
So on my bucket list is for them to succeed in this, for them to experience that same thrill doing the work.
Mm-hmm. What is your advice to them? What should they be wary of? What should they focus on?
Keep at it. Yeah. Keep at it. Talent is just a part of it. Yeah. The hard work is actually what brings you to your goals.
On that note, hard work brings you to your goals. Thank you so much for being part of Danish Originals. We really appreciate you being with us.
No worries.
No worries. All right. For today's episode, Lars Mikkelsen chose LA Rings, Når toget ventes, Jernbaneoverkørsel ved Roskilde Landevej, og Waiting for the Train, Level Crossing by Roskilde Highway, from 1914, from the collection of the National Gallery of Denmark.
You've been listening to Danish Originals, a podcast series that spotlights Danes who have made a significant impact in the U.S. in the areas of creativity, originality, and innovation. The series is directed by Christian D. Brun and hosted by Tina Jung Christensen, along with Gregers Herring, Asker Hussein, Finolf Jones, Nikolai Rotbo, and Carsten Solchuk Shack. It is produced by Teresa Lai, mastered by Sean Hettinger and Greg Williams, with original music by Joachim Swarm and executive produced by Christian D. Brun and Tina Jung Christensen. We invite you to subscribe to Danish Originals wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this episode, we ask you to share it with others, give us a 5-star rating, and leave a review that will encourage others to listen. To stay in touch, you can also find us on danishoriginals.com and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Danish Originals is a fiscally sponsored project of Nordic Concepts Institute. We thank our supporters for seasons 1 to 10, who include founding sponsor American Friends of Statens Museum for Kunst, inaugural sponsor Studio Haslund, and sponsor Scan Design Foundation. We are additionally grateful to Scandinavian Airlines for featuring select episodes on their in-flight programming on long-haul flights. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you next week.